I'd like to suggest that we can practice to reach this thing called unity consciousness, where we begin to treasure our divinity and see ourselves as pieces of God. It's almost as if you have to get to this place where you can say, I'm turning this thing over to God, and God is that to which I am always connected. I am never separate from it. There is no place that God is not. And if there is no place that God is not, not a person, not a white dead male floating around in heaven, but a presence, omnipresence, always, everywhere, at once. Omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. All of them start with Om. And omnipresence and omniscience and omnipotence is something to which I am connected. I'm like that glass of water taken from the ocean. The ocean is God, and I am a glass. I am a glass of God. I'm not as big, not as strong, but always a glass of God, always connected. And it's only when I separate from my source and attempt then to live my life separate from that source that I begin to encounter things called problems. Because when you're separate from your source, that water, separate from its source, is your ego. And that water, separate from its source, cannot create life. It cannot sustain life. It just simply evaporates, changes form, and returns to its source, which is exactly what you're in the process of doing right now, changing form and returning to your source. But while you're separate from your source, you lose all of the power of your source. So what I'd like to suggest that in moving into this place where you are able to turn it over to this thing called God, just turning it over and admitting that it's something that you don't quite know how to handle, and the reason you can't handle it is because you're ego-identified. But as you begin to become more conscious of your divinity, just conscious of your divinity, that you have the power to negotiate the presence of this energy to do incredible things for yourself. But there are three things you have to do. The first is you have to have what I call recognition of this force. And recognition of this force is nothing more than simply saying to yourself, I am open to the idea that there is a force that is greater than I am, to which I am always connected, that is everywhere at once, and no place that it is not. And I would like to just say that it is available to me. Just, you don't have to have proof of it. You don't have to have anybody confirm it. It is just simply an awareness that it exists. See, once you recognize that this force that opens the flowers, that keeps the planet in alignment, that grows your fingernails every night and beats your heart, independent of your opinion about it. You go to sleep at night, you look at your fingernails the next morning, they're longer than they were the night before, and you're sound asleep. Not only that, but whatever force it was that grew yours, grew the person next to you, and grew the people across the oceans as well. There's a force that's growing everybody's fingernails, whether they like it or not, and growing their hair, well, most of them. And beating their hearts, and circulating their food, and opening the flowers, and turning, you know, acorns into oak trees, and turning embryos into human beings. There's a force. There's something. I can't see it. I don't know what it is. I recognize it. If you recognize it, and that there's no place that it's not, the beauty of that is that it's also then in everything that you would like to attract into your life. And here you've just taken one step towards diminishing the role of the ego in your life. If you can recognize that there is a power in the universe that is connected, that is part of you. If there's no place that it is not, then it has to be in you. And if it is in you, and there's no place that it's not, it also has to be in whatever you'd like to attract into your life. So all you have to say is, I'm already connected to that which I would like to attract into my life. That what you want, wants you. All you have to do is somehow figure out a way to realign your inner intention and recognize I am not separate from it. I am connected to it. It just hasn't shown up in my space yet. But I'm already connected to it. That's a very powerful insight. That's why people at higher levels of consciousness can manifest, because there's no delay between what they put in their attention on and having it show up. That's why the gift of fish and loaves is the ability to see hungry people and to think food, and it shows up. And even the least among you can do all that I have done. It's all within you to be able to do that. So that shifting takes place first and foremost with the recognition that there is a force, there is a power. That's how you treasure your divinity. The second thing that you do is what I call realization. And realization is the time in your life when you stop telling yourself that I believe this or don't believe this on the basis of what somebody else says or does. It comes from my own personal direct experience. It's the only thing I will rely upon. I will not rely upon it, the written word. I will not rely upon the spoken word. I will not rely upon someone else out there telling me that this is what God is or how it works. I will rely upon the realization of it through my own direct conscious experience. And I will not try to persuade anybody else. I will not listen to or argue with anybody about whether it's real or not real, whether it works or doesn't work. I know it. Be still and know. And you have that knowing, and the realization is there, and you trust in that realization. I trust in my own experience. I've had it. I have talked to this force. I have seen it work. I've put my attention on it. I've been able to manifest what I want in my life. I've been able to heal myself. I've been able to help heal others. I've been able to feel comfort in times when others feel sadness. These are all things that I know come to me through my direct experience of God. And it doesn't matter what anybody else out there says or does. Realization. I now realize it and trust in that. That's the second step. And the third, I call reverence. And reverence is where you begin to have a daily commune with this power, with this force. That you are not only aware of it, but you are communing quietly with it. You're communing quietly with it. And as you commune quietly with it, I told a story in A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. I want to read it because I want to make sure I have it exact. A disciple once came to a teacher to learn how to meditate on God. The teacher gave him instructions, but the disciple soon returned and said that he could not carry them out. Every time he tried to meditate, he found himself thinking about his pet buffalo. "Well then," said the teacher, "you meditate on that buffalo that you're so fond of." The disciple shut himself up in a room and began to concentrate on the buffalo. After some days, the teacher knocked at his door and the disciple answered, "Sir, I'm sorry, I can't come out to greet you. This door is too small. My horns will be in the way." Then the teacher smiled and said, "Splendid. You have become identified with the object of your concentration. Now fix that same concentration upon God, and you will easily succeed." Use that as a metaphor for reverence. Reverence means I not only recognize it, I know there's a force, I not only have a realization of it, that I trust in my own awareness of it, but I have a reverence for it in which I am communing daily with it and allowing it to become a part of my life. And that is treasuring your divinity. The final aspect of treasuring your divinity is something that is called gratitude. It's having an attitude of gratitude about everything. I talked earlier about the difference between appreciation and depreciation. And in the state of appreciation, you are looking for all that is good and great and beautiful. Truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. That's all there is to know on earth, and all you need to know, said John Keats. Well, gratitude is something that is an awareness of how fortunate I am. I can't tell you that when I was in that cardiac ward, wondering what was going to happen when I went into that cath lab, what they were going to see and what I was going to face, whether they're going to crack open my chest and do bypasses, or whether I was going to have a simple little procedure and move on with it. I can't tell you how grateful I was for the endless number of people who were there to serve me. First of all, for that hospital building. Wow. It was just within blocks of my home, and I was able to walk in there, and I was immediately greeted by people who wanted me to sit in a chair, and then they wanted to put little tubes in, and they wanted to take different samples of my blood and urine and so on, and then they wanted to take pictures of my heart with echocardiograms, and they had all of this incredible equipment. I thought about all the people I was there who invented this equipment that wasn't there. And they talked to me about something called stents to be put in to keep an artery from closing up again. And I looked in a book that was written in 1995, just 6 years before, and I looked up stents in this book about health, heart disease and how to overcome it, and the word stent wasn't in there. And I thought, what kind of a book is this? This guy doesn't even know about stents. And then I discovered that they weren't even invented until 1996 or 97. And that when they wheeled me in there, there were nurses on call 24 hours a day, and endless numbers of people who kept coming in and talking to me and caring about me and trying to console me and trying. It was just a progression of. I went from feeling sorry for myself and looking at all of the people around me who were in much worse condition than me, and then being so grateful for all of the people who worked 24 hours a day. Doctors who come in, in the middle of the night, in the middle of their sleep, and just wake, disrupt their whole lives just to come in because somebody's got a chest pain or because somebody is complaining about something. I mean, that's incredible dedication. I thought, I'll never put a doctor down again in my life. And even in a joking kind of way. And they say, with all the lawyer jokes that are out there, you can make all of them that you want. But when you are in trouble and you need somebody to help you legally, boy, you forget the lawyer jokes. And you're looking for somebody who can help you to run through the mazes that were. You start to have this attitude of gratitude. And someone handed me something here the other day. It's called As the World Turns, and someone took it off of the computer. So if we could shrink the Earth's population to a village, and the village had 100 people in it, with all of the existent human ratios remaining the same. So all we've got is 100 people on the whole planet. Here's what that village would look like. There would be 57 of those people would be Asians. 21 of them would be Europeans. And 14 would be from the Western Hemisphere, both North and South. 8 would be Africans, 52 of those people would be female, 48 would be male, 70 of them would be non-white, and 30 would be white. I'd be a minority. I don't know if I can handle that. 70 would be non-Christian, 30 would be Christian. 89 would be heterosexual, 11 would be homosexual. 6 people would possess 59% of the entire world's wealth. 6 people would have all 59% of the world's wealth, and all 6 of them would be from the United States. 80 of the 100 people would live in substandard housing. 70 would be unable to read. 50 would suffer from malnutrition. Half. 1 would be near death, and 1 would be near birth. 1, only 1, would have a college education. And 1, only 1, would own a computer. 99 wouldn't. When you consider our world from such a compressed perspective, the need for acceptance, understanding, and gratitude becomes glaringly apparent. So therefore, it concludes, if you have food in the refrigerator, clothes on your back, a roof overhead, and a place to sleep, you're richer than 75% of the world. Just that. Doesn't that call for some gratitude? If you woke up this morning with more health than illness, you are more blessed than the million who will not survive this week because of illness. If you have money in your bank, any money in the bank, or even in your wallet, and spare change in a dish someplace in your life, you are among the top 8% of the world's wealthy. 92% of the people don't have that. If you can attend a church meeting without fear, that is, fear of arrest or torture or death, you are more blessed than 3 billion people in the world. And if you've never experienced the danger of battle or the loneliness of imprisonment or the agony of torture or the pangs of starvation, you're ahead of 500 million people in the world today. If your parents are still alive or still married, you are very rare, even in the United States. So, if you have the opportunity to think as you choose to think, to worship as you choose to worship, and you have a little bit of change in your pocket, and you've got your health, and you've got someone that cares about you, then you have an awful lot to be grateful for. And treasuring our divinity means being in a constant state of appreciation, looking for occasions to be joyful, to be happy, to be in a state of gratitude. Every time I find a penny or a nickel or a dime on the street, anytime, I bend over, I pick it up, and I say, "Thank you, God," as a reminder of the abundance that flows into my life when I'm just walking and breathing. Treasuring your divinity doesn't mean not having respect for God. It means respecting the God that is always with you. This principle is called wisdom is avoiding all thoughts which weaken you. And I want to expand upon that. I've talked about it throughout this program, but I want to expand upon it and give some specifics. Much of it, of course, is based upon the wonderful research of a man I've come to admire enormously. His name is David Hawkins. He's a medical doctor. And he lives in Sedona, Arizona. And he's written a couple of books that I have recommended and purchased. I've purchased 11,000 copies of Power Versus Force and had them distributed throughout my talks and throughout the country. And Hay House, I'm proud to say, who publishes this program, is also publishing that book. And it took a while to convince him to do that. One of the things that he did was he calibrated and tested all of Louise Hay's work and their company and the people that were there before he would allow them to publish it. He's also written another book, which is much more in-depth. It's called The Eye of the Eye, the E-Y-E of the Eye. And it's just been released, and I'm encouraging Hay House to take that one as well. Subtitle of that is The Eye of the Eye, From Which Nothing is Hidden. And I would like to share my understanding of some of this and apply my own thoughts to it, giving always credit and tribute where it belongs to someone who has spent a good part of his professional life in creating what he calls a map of consciousness. Every thought that we have has an energy component to it. As I talked about earlier, nothing happens until something moves. Everything in the universe is energy. Everything. There are no exceptions. And energy isn't good and bad and right and wrong and moral and immoral. Energy is just high and low, fast and slow. And higher and faster energy is energy that nullifies and dissolves lower and slower energy. And one of our goals is to attempt to begin to calibrate our lives at a faster and a higher frequency, a more spiritual frequency, if you will. It's what my life has been about for the past few years in my most recent writing and speaking. What Dr. Hawkins has done is he has created a scale that goes between 0 and 1,000. And 200 represents the number at which you have the boundary between that which weakens you and that which strengthens you. Any number that calibrates below 200 will weaken you. Any number that calibrates above 200 will strengthen you. And the distinction between 200 below and 200 above is this, that below 200 you cannot distinguish between truth and a falsehood. And above 200 you can distinguish between truth and a falsehood. And it's all done through kinesthesiology tests, which have been used for many, many years, but he has refined it and researched it to such an extent that they've been able to calibrate, and through yes and no questions, and I'm not going to go into all the research modalities and the explanation of it. You can read those books I've just mentioned, and it's all explained very much in depth in there. But that's the suggestion I'm offering here, just for you to have a mind that is open to something new and not attached, is that there is a credible amount of research behind this. And by and large, it's done through yes and no questions and a muscle testing response, in which it has been discovered that the body does not react to falsehood. It will not make you strong, rather. So that anything that is a lie of any kind, your muscles automatically will respond to weaken you. So that if you hold your arm out and someone pushes down on your arm and you are asked a question that has a falsehood as a basis, that you will always go weak. That the body itself doesn't know how to react to falsehood. It can only react to truth. It's such is the calibration of the human body and the muscles in the human species. But that many, many people over the centuries have been convinced about something called a lie, or something that just is a falsehood, it doesn't have any ring of truth to it. And that up until about 1985 or so, all of humanity totally calibrated at below 200. So that about 1985, there was a shift that took place where mankind finally moved to a level called 207 approximately. All of this is done through these calibrations. And it can be calibrated every historical figure that ever walked among us. All of the great literature. In the eye of the eye, he takes the entire Bible and every book of the Bible and goes through a calibration. The Old Testament calibrates at somewhere around 450, which is a very, very high calibration. But the New Testament calibrates up in the 700 or 800s. And as he says in there, if Jesus came here to teach us the Old Testament, there would have been no reason for him to come. The levels above 200 progress up to 1,000, not in a sense of everything being equal. From 200 is the same as to 250, and then 250 is another 50 to 300 and so on. When you get above 600 or so, you're talking about a handful of people on the entire planet. And when you get to 1,000, which is the highest calibrated frequency that any human being who's ever walked among us, based upon what their life was, what they had to say, and even the energy from their work, the highest calibrated human being who ever walked among us was Jesus Christ. Some 2,000 years ago, it's calibrated at 1,000. And it's the only one who ever calibrated at that level in the history of humanity. and only one or two were below, were between 970 and 1,000. And what they are in the various books of the Bible and so on, all of that, if you want to look at and if you're interested in this kind of research, read The Eye of the Eye, and you'll see how it is all detailed quite specifically. Let me go through this map of consciousness, because basically one of the things that he observes is this. All of the great teachers throughout the history of our species have merely taught one thing over and over in whatever language or whatever time. All have said very simply, give up weak attractors for strong attractors. Period. Give up weak attractors for strong attractors. And he says, individuals of great power throughout human history have been those who have totally aligned themselves with powerful attractors. Again and again, they have stated that the power they manifested was not of themselves. Each has attributed the source of the power to something greater than himself. All of the greatest teachers. That there is a power. And the division between power and force, if you look at the cover of the book, power is in white, a higher energy, and force is in dark, a lower energy. And what I'd like to do here is first kind of give you an idea of what the lowest attractors are. That if I were to do a demonstration, and I've done it many times, in fact, I did it on a set of tapes produced by Hay House called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. And if you want to listen to those, you'll hear on one of the tapes and also on the PBS specials, on the videos, I do an actual demonstration of it on the video, bringing a woman out of the audience and having her think and change her thoughts from thoughts that weaken to thoughts that strengthen. And you can see the amazement on her face as she would go from being strong to being weak to being weak to being strong based upon whatever image I would ask her to have in her mind. More intriguing than that, though, is the idea that even photographs have energy, and even books, as I've talked about here in this program. And they've actually done studies where they'll take a photograph of someone who represents high spiritual principles, a Mother Teresa, a Jesus Christ, a Ramana Maharshi, a whomever. And they'll also take a photograph of that which represents very low and weakening energies, a Charles Manson, an Osama bin Laden, an Adolf Hitler, people who have represented evil to the eyes of many people. And they will have, and not, people will not know what photograph that they are holding next to them, next to their chest, next to their heart. And the photograph of the person who represents higher spiritual values above 200 will allow them to stay strong, whereas the photograph of that which represents lower and slower energies will weaken them. And they have done it with all kinds of things. One of the more intriguing things I saw him do was with an apple. And they took an apple that was sprayed with pesticide and one that wasn't. And the person who was having the experiment done on them didn't know one from the other because they both looked identical. And the apple that was organic and pure allowed them to stay strong, whereas the apple that had pesticides on them made them go weak. And we've done it. I've done it many times in blind studies with people in my audiences where I'll put aspartame or saccharin, which always weakens you. 1,000 out of 1,000 cases, it will weaken you. And put it purely into an envelope. Just take packets of it and pour it into an envelope. And then take packets of pure vitamin C, just pure organic vitamin C, and ask the person to take an envelope and pick one or the other. And when they take the one that has saccharin in it, it always makes them go weak, and they didn't even know which one was which. And when they take the one with vitamin C, it always makes them go strong. It almost defies our credibility, our sense of is there really energy in everything? And kinesthesiology is one of the ways that we are learning to test that which will weaken us and that which will strengthen us. And what's most relevant here in this particular program about it never being crowded along the extra mile is that what I'm trying to encourage you to do, what I try to work on in my own life every day, is that when I am having a thought or a picture or an image that is based upon something that will weaken me, and I know what those are, that if I just stay there and change the thought to a thought that is a counter thought that will balance that, counterbalance that, that I not only make myself feel better, but I am no longer having an energy that is going to weaken me. And remember, the heart is a muscle. And the body is surrounded, all of the organs of the body are surrounded by all of these muscles, all of which go weak when you use certain thoughts, or have certain pictures, or put certain substances into your body. Alcohol, drugs, tobacco, things like this, will make people go dramatically weak, almost instantaneously. And he gives all kinds of examples of how and why that works. So this map of consciousness basically goes like this. So when we're talking about 0 to 1,000, remember, once you get above 600, as a matter of fact, here's one of the statements that he made that really set me thinking. He said that when someone calibrates above 600, which on the map of consciousness represents life view of God view of all being, a life view of perfection, a level of peace, the emotion of bliss, and the process of illumination. The highest, almost the highest level, because between 700 and 1,000, there's so few people who've ever been there that it's all lumped into one category. That anybody who calibrates above 600, that is one of those St. Francis type people, who whenever they encounter anything, they always have nothing to send but love, that I've been talking about throughout this program, that everyone who encounters someone who calibrates above 600 and enters their energy field is automatically healed. Such is the energy that they radiate. And Mother Teresa, according to Hawkins, calibrated at 700, one of a handful of people on the planet at that time. And I remember her walking into a room and everybody in the room changing, the energy of the entire room changing. But he said, if you stay in the energy field of someone who calibrates and radiates at this level of consciousness that all of us are capable of achieving, that everyone that you encounter, every living species, will automatically be healed just by being in the presence of that. And most of us know that there are people that we feel better around than others, don't you? You have a sense that when someone walks in the room or someone gets close to you, sometimes their energy is so bad, and it isn't because they have body odor, it isn't because their teeth are crooked or because they've got bad breath or whatever. It's because they come into an energy field and they are lowering the energy that you are with, and you have a sense of feeling worse when they're in your energy space. And you also have a sense of when someone enters your energy field, it can be a total stranger, or it can be someone you respect a great deal, or someone whose work that you have admired, and they come close to you and come into your energy, and you have that warm shower feeling running inside of you. There's something, and all of a sudden there's like a healing that takes place. Remember when I had put you into the gap in the meditation? And when we talked about embracing silence, and when you go into that gap, what you're doing is you're raising your energy level just ever so slightly. But the fact of moving your energy up just in an instant of going into that gap gives you that really sort of warm, good feeling inside of you because you've reconnected to something that is higher. But imagine just being able to radiate out such a level of consciousness. And that's the way it was of Francesco. That's what it was said of St. Francis, that wherever he would go, wild animals that were terrorizing the cattle would become tame. And birds, the famous scene that I always think of in the movie about his life, Brother, Son, Sister Mood by Franco Zeffirelli, of his sermon to the birds, when the birds just all aligned and listened because there was no fear, there was no enmity. All right. So the bottom of this scale is 20. It's the very lowest thought that you can have. And it will always weaken you. Not only will it weaken you, but it will ultimately destroy you, such as this weakness. It's at 20, it's shame. So whenever you feel ashamed, when I've had people come out of an audience and I've done a muscle test on them and I've said, think of a moment in your life when you felt ashamed. You don't have to share what it is. Just think of that moment. And I go to move their arm, and they have absolutely no strength. And then I ask them to think of a moment when they felt most loved, and instantly they go to strong. I go back to shame, they go weak. So if you are using shame on yourself, or you're using shame as a way of parenting or working with others, what you are doing is you are always using an emotional energy that will weaken. The emotion that accompanies shame is called humiliation. And the life view is one of misery, and the God view, the view of God, is one of despising. God despises us. We are ashamed. There's something wrong with us. The next level up, which is very, very low and will always weaken you, is 30, is guilt. Feeling guilty. The emotion that accompanies it is blame. The God view is one of God as vindictive. God is punishing. And the life view is one of life is evil. There's something wrong with life. The next level up is one that's called 50. And this level is the emotion that accompanies that is despair. So that apathy and despair go together. The God view is one of God as condemning. And the life view is that life is hopeless. There's not much that we can do. The next level up is 75, which still weakens us. It's grief. The emotion is regret. God's view is disdainful. And the life view is one of tragic. Life is tragic. We are now moving to 100, which is called fear. And the emotion that accompanies fear is anxiety. The God view is one of punitive. God is punishing. And life view, frightening. Life is frightening. Now we move up to 125, what he calls desire. And the emotion that accompanies that is craving. Always wanting to get someplace else. The life view is one of life is disappointing. And the God view is denial, denying. Now we move to 150. We are still at emotions and thoughts that you have that will weaken you. At 150, the emotion that accompanies it is hate. The life view is that life is antagonistic. And the God view is that God is vengeful. We are now moving closer to that which will strengthen us, to something called pride. Pride. And the emotion that accompanies pride is called scorn. The life view is that life is very demanding. And the God view is that God is indifferent. Doesn't care one way or the other. Now we move to 200. We are now making a distinction between being able to recognize truth from falsehood. This is called courage. And the emotion that accompanies courage is affirmation, affirming, life is affirming. The life view is that it is feasible. And the God view is that God is permitting. God allows us. All right. Now we move to 250. We are now talking about emotions and thoughts which strengthen us. We have moved from force. The ones that I've just described up to 200 represent what he calls force. And I'm going to make a distinction here very shortly between the qualities of force versus the qualities that empower. What does it mean to be in a state of force? What happens? And what does it mean to be in a state of power? But I'd like to go through the rest of this map of consciousness. At 250, trust is the emotion. Neutrality is the level of thought. The life view is life is satisfactory, and that the view of God is that God is enabling. God enables us. We move now to 310, what he calls willingness. Willingness. Whereas the emotion of willingness is something called optimism, an optimistic view of life. The life view is that life is hopeful, And the God view is that God is inspiring. Now we have moved from God being despising and vindictive and punitive and vengeful and indifferent and permitting and enabling to now God is inspiring. At 350, acceptance, the emotion is forgiveness. I accept and I forgive. The life view is that life is harmonious. And the God view is that God is merciful. Mercy. We now move to 400, where very, very few people ever get to, called reason. The emotion of reason is understanding. The life view is that life is meaningful. There's a meaning to all of this. And the God view is that God is not only merciful and inspiring, but God is wise. Wisdom comes with knowing God. Now we move to 500, which we're talking about a handful of people. The level is called love. The emotion is reverence. The life view is that life is benign, non-cancerous, non-debilitating. And the God view is that God is loving. At 540, the level of joy, where there is sadness, let me bring joy, remember. The emotion is serenity, a sense of just being serene in life. The life view is that life is complete. I am complete. And the God view is that all is one. All is one. At 600, the level of peace, the emotion is bliss. So it's not just serenity, but it's bliss, which is that wonderful, great, good feeling, continuous. Life view, life is not only complete, it is perfect. And the God view, all being. And finally, enlightenment, between 700 and 1,000. The emotion that goes with the sense of enlightenment is what he calls the ineffable. Ineffable. Life view, everything is. There's no judgment. And the God view, self. The self is God. And at the end of this, I will do a little reading from to show you how we can apply this. Now, I spoke earlier about the power of a higher energy to nullify a lower energy. Listen to this set of statistics and how important it is for each and every one of us collectively, not just individually, I'm speaking about collectively as a species, to raise the level at which we calibrate so that we can move not only above 200 but into those places where our emotions and our thoughts are not only strengthening us, but strengthening those around us. One avatar, calibrating at 1,000, living among us, would be enough to counterbalance the collective negativity of all of mankind, all 6 billion of us. If one of us could reach that level of 1,000, that ineffable, blissful, always being, that Christ-like being, that the collective negativity of all of mankind would be counterbalanced. And one individual at 700 would counterbalance the negativity of 70 million individuals below 200. Just one person above 700 counterbalances the negativity of 70 million who calibrate below 200. One individual at 600 will counterbalance the negativity of individuals below 200, 10 million people. All you have to do is reach 600. At 500, you counterbalance 750,000 people. At 300, 90,000 people are counterbalanced by just bringing the level of energy that you have to 300 into the world. Just bringing it into the world. Now listen to this alarming statistic that he gives in The Eye of the Eye. The negativity of the entire human population would self-destruct were it not for the counterbalancing effect of those higher energy frequencies. In other words, if we didn't have a given number of people calibrating above 300, if we didn't have them, the collective negativity of humanity and their inability to distinguish falsehood from truth would self-destruct the entire planet. In 1995, there were 22 sages above 700 on the planet. There were 20 at 800. There were 10 over 900 and one at 990, according to the research that they have been doing. We're talking about a handful of people since 1995, and I think it's gone up. In fact, I know it has gone up in looking at some of the more recent research. So that I talked earlier about the ability to practice the prayer of St. Francis, that is, where there is hatred, let me bring love in my own life, and where there is despair, hope, and so on. Now we're talking collectively, if we could figure out a way to just get enough of us to raise the consciousness level at which we calibrate ourselves and bring that collectively to this place over here called force, we could counterbalance all of it with enough of us. I'd like to suggest what I've done is I've gone through all of this work and I have come up with a summary of 12 categories that distinguish power from force. And I've done all of the work for you. So this is what I have gleaned from reading that, from studying it, from putting it into practice, from experimenting with it with friends and family, with having people come out of audiences and do it, with all of the intense research that I have been doing on it. And it excites me so much. I don't know if the excitement is coming through here, but for me, this is the most thrilling kind of affirmation of the need for the work of higher consciousness. And that when we talk about force and we talk about power, what we're really talking about is the distinction between having a life in which all of your thoughts and your energy and your emotions and your life view and your God view calibrate below 200 and weaken you on a regular basis, or moving those God views and those life views and those emotions and those levels to a place where you are always strengthened. And the 10th principle here, for it's never crowded along the extra mile, is wisdom is nothing more than avoiding all thoughts which disempower you, which weaken you, which make you use force rather than power. Okay, and here is my dirty dozen, or my good dozen, all right? The first is that force always creates a counterforce. Force creates a counterforce, whereas power is always creates grace. Grace and power, over and over again, he reports the research, that power is something that will bring grace, that will bring God, will bring consciousness to the presence of it. Whereas force always creates a counterforce. So that when you have a force, that is, if you react with shame, if you try to make your children feel ashamed, what are they going to do back? They resent, and what are they going to try to do to you? Some way of making you feel ashamed as well. It happens every time. You just have to watch it. You try to shame them and watch if they don't try to shame you. You said I couldn't do that and then you have to be punished for that. But you did that. You said this right away. Shame creates more shame. You've created a lowered energy field. They're weakened. You're weakened. And it works not just with shame, but with fear, with anxiety, with anger. Every time we use any of these, a counterforce is created. We've been doing this collectively with mankind as long as there have been mankind to record about. And as long as we use force, which is the energy of the ego, instead of the energy of spirit, we create that. So that's the first. The second quality is that force is always loud, aggressive, whereas power is silent. That you raise energy levels through silence. And there's very little movement required when you are empowering. Whereas when you get louder, screaming, aggressive, more outgoing, and so on. The third is that force is always moving against something. That's what force is. So whatever it is that you have, we have to move against it. We have to mobilize our forces and defeat it. Whereas power does not move at all. Power is that which you get by not having to move against anything. And this will become more clear in a few moments. Force, the fourth thing is that force is always incomplete. Therefore, it must be fed energy. You must constantly feed energy of force. You must constantly be talking to it. You must constantly be upgrading it. You must constantly be trying to make it attract more energy. It's always demanding of energy. Whereas power is total and complete, requires nothing from outside itself. Power does not demand anything out there, not any weapons. It doesn't need any arguments to win. Power is that which you are connected to silently. The fifth, force always makes demands. Whenever you are in force, and if you look at any of those emotions and energy levels below 200, you will see that there's a demand to each one of them. Whereas power has no needs whatsoever. It is at peace. The sixth is force is constantly consuming. It has insatiable appetite. It is constantly demanding more. And in the process, it consumes, and in the process of consuming, it destroys. Power is always content, makes no demands, and needs nothing to consume. Seven, force always takes energy away. It takes your energy and takes it with it. Whereas power energizes. It gives forth. It supplies and supports. And it gives life energy. When you go to God, when you go to Spirit, when you go above 200 to any of those levels, what you are doing is you are energizing those around you and sending it out. Whereas when you're in any of the ones below 200, you are taking energy away. The eighth is that force is always associated with judgments and generally makes us feel badly about ourselves. Any of those emotions, any of those thoughts have to do with judging. And ultimately, when you experience those thoughts or you're in the presence of someone who is using those thoughts, you will end up feeling badly or worse for the experience. Whereas power is associated with compassion, radical humility, and always makes us feel positive about ourselves. When you encounter someone whose thoughts are above 200, after that encounter, you will feel better for having been in their presence based upon not just what you talk about, but even the feelings that you have. Whereas when you're associated with or around people who are using the techniques below 200, you feel yourself feeling badly, worse, and depleted of energy. Number nine, force always polarizes. Because it demands conflict in order to survive. Force and conflict go together. And you know people like this, who are always in a state of conflict, no matter what it is that you say to them, no matter how you say it, and you might try to say it in the nicest possible way. Like, what do you think you could pick up our daughter at 8 o'clock? I'm busy. I've got things to do. I've got fires to put out. I'm a very busy person. And I didn't know I was supposed to do that. Would it be possible for you to be there at 8? If you can't, I'll be happy to be there. You're always doing that. You're always making it my fault. I can't be there. It's like someone who's in a state below 200 is constantly going to create an energy field of conflict. Conflict is necessary because it polarizes, whereas power unifies. I'd be happy to. If you can't make it, I'd be happy to be there. You always feel unified. Power, the energy of power above 200 will unify and make you feel more like you belong, a sense of belonging. Number 10, I just put it this way, in force, the cost is always very high because enemies are always being created. Force needs an enemy. When you have to have an enemy, you have raised the cost. You now have to fight. And when the process of fighting, now you have to create a counterforce. And you pay for it. You pay for it emotionally, you pay for it spiritually, and you pay for it financially. It costs to stay in a state of force. Whereas power has no cost whatsoever. It's absolutely free. It's graceful. It's silent. It's easy. It's non-consuming. It makes no demands. The 11th, and I've always been intrigued by this, the 11th quality or characteristic of force, force always requires proof because it's literal and it's therefore arguable. So argumentation is in the demanding of proof. Prove it to me. You've got to be able to prove. I need some statistics. I need to know exactly why it is that you can come up with that. And there'll be people who will do that in listening to this program. And just know that I'm at peace. And there's no cost and I'm not interested. But if you need to have proof of some of these kinds of things, you'll never get it. All right? So there is this requirement of proof that comes with force. Whereas power deals with intangibles. And it knows that health is better than disease. It doesn't need any proof of that. It knows that honor is better than dishonor. It knows that faith is better than doubt. And that being constructive is better than destructive. And you don't need a chi-square. And you don't need an analysis of variance. And you don't need a statistical test to be able to prove it, and you don't need to argue about it. There's an awareness that is internal, that is instinctive, that says, I don't have to go out there and show anything. It's why it's quiet. I know it is better to be honorable than it is to be dishonorable. I know it is better to be honest than to steal. I don't need proof of that. I know that it is better to be healthy than to be in a state of disease. I know that life is better than death. I know this. I don't have to prove it. I don't have to explain it. I live in a consciousness of empowerment in which I don't have to go through and look outside of myself to validate whether these things that I know instinctively and intuitively are correct. Whereas force requires something very different. And finally, force is always associated with sickness. And empowerment and power is always associated with health. And there you have a summary. You have a map of consciousness in which an arbitrary scale between 0 and 1,000 has been created. Research has been done on it. You can check it for yourself. And in the process of looking at this, whether it's true or not, and whether those numbers are exact or not exact, is of no relevance to me whatsoever. It's what it did for me. First of all, it gave me the 10th principle, that wisdom is really avoiding thoughts which weaken us. And that's what the greatest teachers have been doing since the beginning of recorded history, is trying to teach us how to strengthen and empower ourselves as a people rather than to weaken ourselves. And it gives us an opportunity to look at the way that we think and the emotions that come as a result of those thoughts and our life view and our God view and how they relate to any set of circumstances in our life. It gives us that opportunity. And it also shows us the power of energy. That everything, including every thought and every emotion, is something that we have control over in any given moment of our lives. And that we can individually bring that higher energy to face off in those lower energies and disempower it. And collectively, if enough of us move into these higher levels, imagine, just imagine what could take place. And what I'd like to do is share with you a way that he presents this in Power versus Force that seems to bring it all home very clearly. Let's attempt to understand all of this through an example. Imagine a bum on a street corner in a fashionable neighborhood. Can you get a picture of that? Bum, street corner, fashionable neighborhood. In a fashionable neighborhood in a big city stands an old man in tattered clothes, alone, leaning against the corner of an elegant brownstone. Look at him from the perspective of various levels of consciousness and note the differences in how he appears. From the bottom of the scale, at a level of 20, the level of shame, this bum is dirty, disgusting, and disgraceful. And that's how you view him. And you know people who do. And you may know yourself as having done that at one time. From the level of 30, which is guilt, he would be blamed for his condition. He deserves what he gets. He's probably a lazy welfare cheat. At 50, hopelessness, his plight would appear desperate, damning evidence that society can't do anything about homelessness. At 75, grief, the old man looks tragic, friendless, and forlorn. At a consciousness level of 100, fear, we might see him as threatening, a social menace. Perhaps we could call the police before he commits some crime. At 125, desire, he might represent a frustrating problem. Why doesn't somebody do something? At 150, anger, the old man might look like he could be violent. Or on the other hand, you might become furious that such conditions exist in the first place. At 175, we're still at levels that still weaken you, pride, he could be seen as an embarrassment or as lacking the self-respect to better himself. And at 200, courage, now we're at the distinction between truth and falsehood and that which empowers rather than weakens. We're at power rather than force. At 200, we might be motivated to wonder if there's a local homeless shelter. All he needs is a job and a place to live. At 250, neutrality, the bum looks okay. Maybe even interesting. Live and let live, we might say. After all, he's not hurting anyone. At 310, willingness, we might decide to go down and see what we can do to cheer this fellow up. Or volunteer some time, perhaps, at a local mission. At 350, acceptance, the man on the corner appears intriguing. He probably has an interesting story to tell. He's where he is for reasons we may never understand. At 400, reason, he's a symptom of the current economic and social malaise, or perhaps a good subject for in-depth psychological study. Now we move to the higher levels. At the higher levels, the old man begins to look not only interesting, but friendly, then lovable. Perhaps we would then be able to see that he was, in fact, one who had transcended social limits and gone free. Maybe a joyful old guy with the wisdom of age in his face and the serenity that comes from indifference to material things. At 600, peace, the highest level any of us will ever attain here, he is revealed as one's own self in a temporary condition. Can you see the difference? Can you see the distinctions between how we look at things, a simple bum standing on a corner, and all of the attendant ways that we have of processing it, some of which will weaken us individually and collectively, and some of which will empower us individually and collectively. So let me summarize my top 10 with apologies to David Letterman. My top 10. These are principles that I don't think have to be that complicated. Principles that are characteristic of those who take the road less traveled, who are on the uncrowded mile. And here they are. If you can live them and practice them and work on them or help others to do so, perhaps we can collectively begin to counterbalance some of the negativity of those who can't make the distinction between falsehood and truth. Have a mind that is open to everything, attached nowhere. Go through life with an idea that anything is possible. Don't die with your music still in you. Listen to the voices you hear, regardless of what others may say. Remember, you can never give away what you don't have. So if you're looking for love, don't look in all the wrong places. Look inside, give it away, and you'll attract it into your life. Embrace silence. Know that God's one and only voice is silent, and all of your creativity and all that you are destined to be able to do here when you showed up with this heroic mission is in the void. It's in the silence, and it will come out of that silence. Give up your personal history. Don't be attached to all that has happened in the past. It's just a wake. It's just a trail that is left behind. And the wake can never drive the boat. Remind yourself always that whatever problems you have, you can't solve them with the same mind that created it. Rewrite your agreement with reality. Make anything up your possibility. Rid yourself of all of those resentments that you justify. There are no justifiable resentments. They will all destroy you. Treat yourself as if you already were what you would really like to become. Act it out. See yourself as having abundance. See yourself as being healthy. See yourself as being happy. See yourself playing that trumpet, and you won't be able to do anything else. Treasure your divinity. God doesn't make any junk. And finally, remind yourself that to be wise is to avoid all thoughts which weaken you. And every thought you have does one or the other, will either weaken or strengthen you. I think of those who don't recognize this great power, this force that is in everything and everyone, that opens the flowers and allows the butterflies to flap their wings, and who thinks it's all some great big accident. I think of a junkyard, and this junkyard has millions and millions and millions of pieces of junk. It's got broken glass. It's got old seats and toilets. It's got wiring everywhere and old transformers and old pieces of electricity. It's got every kind of piece of junk that you can imagine in this huge acre of land. And you look at all of this junk all laying around, and suddenly, out of nowhere, a hurricane is forming. And the winds start blowing. And it passes over this junkyard filled with all of these seemingly disconnected pieces of junk. And it blows them all up into the air. And they're all twirling around into the air. Broken glass and broken seats and transformers and electrical equipment and asbestos and pieces of upholstery. It's just everywhere, all in the air, just flying around. And the wind passes, And when it settles down, there's a brand new Boeing 747 sitting there in that vacant land. What are the chances? What are the odds? Don't you think that behind a 747 with 3 million parts, that there's an intelligence? There's some kind of a force that puts it all together, organizes it, and makes it work and fly and be something of value? Then think about this universe and all of the moving pieces and all of the moving parts, including yourself, and all of those that you see around you. Only it's trillions upon trillions upon trillions of pieces, and galaxies and endless more galaxies. Don't you think that behind all of this, there is some intelligence, some force, somehow, some creative energy that you're a part of? If you get it and understand it, you'll be able to fly without that Boeing 747. I love this story of the Buddha. And the Buddha is traveling. And everywhere he travels, he encounters criticism and hate and disrespect from all of these people who have done nothing but choose to see if they can bring him down. And always he responds with peace. Always he responds with love. And after 3 or 4 days of seeing these people continuously harassing him and ridiculing him and finding fault with him and being ugly and so on, his devotees say, how can you do that? After 3 days of nothing but receiving that kind of energy, you still always have love. And the Buddha answered this question with a question. He said, if someone offers you a gift and you do not accept that gift, to whom does the gift belong? And what he's saying is, if someone offers you a gift of their negativity, of their lower energy, of their criticism, of their hatred or whatever, and you simply don't accept it, who owns it? And if they own it and it's theirs, why would you allow yourself to be upset, depressed, stressed, hurt by something that is owned elsewhere? That's all you have to remind yourself of. And you'd be surprised. You know, it's a good thing to work on. It's a good thing to practice, especially if you have kids, because, boy, they give you so many opportunities to do this, where you can work at seeing if you can change that energy around, if you can make it go from low to high. Just see if you can raise it just ever so slightly. All of you instinctively know how to do it, because you're born with that quality. It's just that we've lost it when we took on the ego. Thank you, and God bless you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
This has been a Hay House audiobook production. If you would like a free catalog of books and videos offered by Hay House, please call us at 1-800-654-5126. Thank you for listening.